Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast. Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your host, Amelia.
And Beth, who apparently is very wrong about a lot of things.
Well, just a couple of things. So last week's episode, we did ghost stories on North Shore, and Beth added a story from Gardner. And when we put the story out to all you listeners, we wrote in the description, spooky spots in Salem, Billerica, and Gardner, which we know isn't in the North Shore, and we know that. So we right off the bat said that. A couple of people
I don't think anybody reads the show notes.
I don't either, but I did write it in there. And three people reached out to us.
But what was even funnier is that while we were talking about it last week on the show, Amelia did point out, you know, like Gardner is not on the North Shore. And I specifically remember saying, well, it's in the northern part of the state.
Yeah.
But apparently that must have been in the middle of some banter that you guys didn't get to hear, because I've been cutting out all the extraneous chatter because the episodes are coming in really long lately, like this one, as I explain why I might have cut that out. Let's cut this out.
So anyway, so a bunch of people, like three people, wrote in, and like the fact that three people are even listening to the show is just amazing. So thank you, everyone. One person in particular I want to point out is Tammy. And Tammy, we have talked to you about before. She has a cool YouTube channel. She's really nice. She's a realtor in Massachusetts. Hey, Tammy. I follow her YouTube. It's very good. So she said, I'm currently listening to your latest episode, Spooky Stories of the North Shore Kid. I love you guys so much, but I have to say it's killing me to hear the S.K. Pierce Mansion story on a North Shore episode. Central Mass has so much good stuff, and we hate being lumped in with other areas of Massachusetts. So then I'm just like, haha, Beth takes her liberties. And then later, Tammy is real-time Instagramming me. I'm sorry, now I'm at the Dudley Road portion, and my husband grew up on the road, and the house didn't sink. You can see the foundation. I guess it was built to look like a roof. So there you go. There's our corrections corner.
All right. Well, thank you, Tammy.
Everyone who reached out. Thank you, Tammy, who somehow Tammy knew a lot about that episode. There's a lot That's of cool. connections. Thanks, Tammy, and everyone else. So anyway, this week.
Yeah, what are we doing this week?
We're not talking about Central Mass again, I'll tell you that. We are talking
I don't know about that. I have no sense of geography.
So this week, as we all heard on one of our listener emails a few weeks ago, where someone was like, hey, do Western Mass. And since we already did the South Shore, and we already did the North Shore, and we already did Gardner, which, like, how much more Central Mass do you need? Just kidding, Tammy. We figured that this week we would do Western Mass. I don't know. Have we really done much out of Western Mass? We did the Tom Reed UFO Park. That was kind of cool. We had him on. That was neat.
We did
a lot out there.
We did something out in Worcester.
That's not Western Mass. That's Central Mass. You're doing it again, Beth. I feel like once you get to Worcester, everything else in Massachusetts is a mystery. And I was surprised, Beth, because there is a ton of haunted stories in Western Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Did you expect there to be that many? I was not prepared for how many there were.
Well, I don't know that there were more than I was expecting. I think that we have a lot of haunted places all over Massachusetts and New England. I feel like when we've been out searching for different stories, I always feel like I have to pick between a whole bunch of really good options, because we only want the episodes to be about an hour. Otherwise, we could probably talk about 25 locations every time we pick a place.
Yeah, but I know I was actually quite surprised, because no one really, like, Western Mass is not as populated as the rest of the state by, like, any means.
Oh, no. It's
not at all. It's very, like, Mike and Lauren, their town has 800 people who live in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I grew up in a small town, and my town had 10,000 people, and that was a small town.
Yeah, it's
super weird.
It's a strange
area. Weird. Yeah, anything else, Beth?
No.
All right. Do you want to start with your stories first?
What I am going to talk about is the Deerfield Inn. So the Deerfield Inn is in, believe it or not, Deerfield, Massachusetts. So it is definitely out in the western part. Would you like me to show you on the map?
I know where it is.
All right. So it was built in 1884 by the Bradley brothers. They had another property at the center of town that had burned down in a fire. And instead of rebuilding on the spot that they had been on previously, they decided to build it where the current inn is because it's next to the river. So there were some ideas that maybe they picked that spot because if it's next to the river, they're less likely to lose the whole thing due to fire again, right? Nice water source right there to throw on if there's any issues. Anyway, so 1884, they build it, you know, life goes on. They end up selling it to John and Cora Carlisle, who owned it when John died in 1932. And then following that, Cora held a series of seances in the inn trying to contact John. So whether or not she contacted John, I don't know. I don't have any information about that. But she did the seances in room. I read there were two different rooms. One is room 148 and the other one is 48. So I think there might have been a typo. Just it got a one thrown in there somewhere along the line. But that is the room with most of the activity going on. So they have three active spirits that haunt the inn. There's Cora Carlisle. She's known to be very bossy. She walks around like she's in charge. She's checking everything out. She is a full body apparition that appears. She's dressed in her dressing gown, but she's transparent. You can see through her. She is seen all over the inn. And when it comes time to go to bed at night, some people in the inn will find themselves getting like a gentle push on the back that it's time to go to bed. That's Cora just letting them know. Cora's husband, John, also seems to hang out around the Deerfield Inn still. He's seen most often in the living room, and he's just going about regular business type stuff. One of the things that happens a lot in the Deerfield Inn is that the furniture gets moved all over the place. Like you'll leave a room, take two steps down the hall, turn back into the room, and a table that was against the wall is now in the middle of the room. Like weird stuff like that. So people wonder actually if it's John who is moving the tables to the center of the room because he's just there to like do business, right? He's not interested in interacting with people like Cora is. He's just there to make sure that stuff gets done. So that's kind of neat. And the third ghost that's there is someone named Herschel. Now, Herschel, this is just what the staff calls him. Nobody's really sure what his name really is. He appears as a bright box of bouncing light. So he's not like a body shape and he's not an orb. He's bigger and he bounces, which I just thought was so neat. He's also very messy, right? And he's a prankster a little bit. So he'll go into people's rooms and he takes all the tissues out of the tissue box and just pulls them all out, sprays them all over the floor. He likes to take books and magazines and he'll just strew them all over your room on you. He will move your luggage around. He will occasionally apparently rearrange the furniture. He's most often felt in room 48. So that's the room that has most of the crazy stuff that goes on. He also really seems to like when kids visit. And when kids visit, he'll go over, it's an old Victorian home. And so they have a big porch on the front. And they have rocking chairs on the porch and he'll go over and push the chairs to entertain the kids. There's stories by the staff, you know, things that staff have seen. One of the ones that I really liked was one of the waiters had filled up a jug with water and put the jug on the counter. And at that time gets called over to grab something off the line in the kitchen. And the cook who called him over watches behind the waiter as the jug of water slides from the back of the counter to the front of the counter and falls on the floor.
Like,
oh, it's that Herschel. He's around again. He's doing things. He'll go out and do things to the wait staff in the restaurant. Like he walks over and as you're putting down someone's food, he'll knock your hand so you drop their food. He'll walk over and, you know, just cup right out of your hand. Your whole tray, he upends the tray. He's a very expensive ghost, I guess. But yeah, so he's kind of funny. He likes to spill a lot of items. I'm not sure if he's a young boy or he's just, you know, he's definitely a male presence, or is he a, you know, a young man who just enjoys, you know, like having fun with kids, or is he, you know, like a middle-aged guy? He's some sort of male presence, but it's very interesting. I think that it's cute that it would be like a little boy who's going around like just a happy ball of light, trying to entertain other kids who are on vacation. Yeah, that's my story about the Deerfield Inn. If you want to go and see if you can maybe stay in room 48 or 148, I'm not sure. I bet if you call and ask, they'll let you know which one the haunted room is, because it's all over their website about the fact that the place is haunted. It seems to run between $180 and $260 a night, and you can locate it at 81 Old Main Street in Deerfield, Massachusetts.
Good story, Beth.
Thanks.
That's great.
Yeah. I would absolutely go out and stay at the Deerfield Inn. It just seems like it would be a fun thing. There weren't any like terrible stories of scary things happening. So
nice.
I like when it's not scary.
Yeah.
So what do you got?
So my next story comes to us from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. We are talking about Thaddeus Clapp House in the Clapp Park. So I want to point out, too, that I got a lot of this information off of the Berkshire Theater website. They're involved with like restorations. They just had like a ton of history on their website. So go check them out. It's a great website. And I got a lot of info from them. Okay.
Thaddeus Clapp House. You keep going. What? Don't you live in the Clapp House?
I live in the Eunice Clapp House. They are related. That's why I picked this story.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes. Thaddeus Clapp was a descendant of Captain Roger Clapp, who sailed to Massachusetts from England in the mid-1600s. Captain Clapp was instrumental in founding of Dorchester, and the Clapp family has been immortalized in Dorchester through the Dorchester Historical Society, whose headquarters is the historic William Clapp House, listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The Clapp family grew to encompass many branches throughout New England, and each branch found a unique way to distinguish themselves. In Western Mass, the Clapps ranged from clergy to farmers and even to tavern owners. Thaddeus Clapp I owned the tavern in East Hampton, which he inherited from his father. In addition to being a business owner, Thaddeus Clapp I served as treasurer and justice for the peace of his town. Clapp went on to become a delegate to the Constitutional Convention of the state. He and his wife, Achess Parsons, had seven children, including Thaddeus II. Who had become Colonel Thaddeus Clapp. Colonel Clapp moved to Pittsfield in 1816 and became superintendent of the Pittsfield Woolen and Cotton Factory. He held the position until the Pontusuk Woolen Manufacturing Company was formed in 1825. He held the position of superintendent there until 1860. It was shortly after Colonel Clapp's tenure at Pontusuk Woolen Factory Company the Thaddeus Clapp House on Wendell Avenue was built and purchased. Though Colonel Thaddeus Clapp passed away in 1965, just 5 years later, his son, Thaddeus Clapp III, continued on with his legacy. Wendell Avenue, where the Thaddeus Clapp House sits, was home to numerous businessmen in the 1800s and early 1900s, an appropriate home for Pittsfield's prominent citizens, as it was named after Colonel Jacob Wendell, the Wendell family that helped to acquire the land and form Pittsfield in the 1700s. Thaddeus Clapp III built upon the Pontusuk Woolen, and I'm so sorry, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong every time, manufacturing company that his father helped to start. Though he did not go to college, Clapp learned about the wool trade from his youngest days and was taught everything he knew by his father. Clapp was a determined businessman and ensured that the goods produced always kept with ever-changing styles and trends of the day. I would like to point something out. So this is in like the 1800s. Like how many people were going to college? Like I don't think it would have been that unusual to not go to college and to take over a family business.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been unusual at all. And in fact, I think it would have been strange to have gone to college. You already had a job. You were going to take over the family business.
And why? Like, it's just like, it was just a weird thing that I found there. Like, so he didn't go to college, but he learned about the wool trade from his youngest day. So it almost sounds like, well, he should have gone to college to learn about wool, but there wasn't like wool college.
No, I would be very surprised if there was wool college. Right? I think most colleges were at that time really focused on professional, you know, like
law.
You should be a lawyer or a doctor. If you're going to be some sort of like, or you'd be a scholar, right?
Like, yeah.
Most people I don't think went to college for fun.
Okay. So to ensure the quality was never sacrificed, he exclusively used California wool. Throughout his tenure, Clapp made dozens of trips to California to select the wool himself. He eventually became president of the Poonsock Woolen Manufacturing Company and held that position from 1882 to 1891. His son decided not to take over the company, and it was sold to an outside buyer. Like the mill, the Thaddeus Clapp House passed out the Clapp family in the early 1900s. The home on Wendell Avenue was then sold in 1906 to William Whitsley, manager of the Pittsfield Electric Company that supplied electricity to the city of Pittsfield. The Thaddeus Clapp House remained a private residence into the 1930s. Eventually, the home became a boarding house and apartment complex, though it continued to house prominent Pittsfield members, including members of the Francis and Briggs families. So since the 1930s, it has been continually occupied either as apartments or bed and breakfast. And then there were like a lot of renovations going on at it all the time. There are some renovations going on right now too. So throughout the years, guests of the bed and breakfast report seeing a figure of a woman. And they think that that woman is Mrs. Clapp drifting throughout the house. Now, you just heard me, Beth, talk a lot about all this history.
Mm-hmm.
And nowhere does it mention Mrs. Clapp. It mentions Clapp the first Clapp's wife briefly, and that they had seven children, but that's not who had the house. So I looked, I couldn't find anything on her, but people think that's who it is. And this ghost always feels warm. It always feels nice. It's like warm, fuzzy feelings in the house. And it's said that she's especially seen kind of around the holidays.
Oh, and that's sweet.
And like a lot of joy and happiness and like nice feelings. One reported sighting was from a guest who stayed there like around Christmas. And he said, or I guess she said, that she saw like a whole ghost staff preparing for the holiday.
Wow.
So like she like walked in on the scene. So
That's very reminiscent of The Shining.
Yes.
Yeah.
So according to local legend, I found this, playwright Peter Bergman had a ghostly encounter while visiting here. So I looked up who this Peter Bergman was, and there's a very famous actor, like TV actor, Peter Bergman. But I'm like, it specifies playwright. So I looked at him more, and he's just, and like, I'm sure he's a playwright. I mean, I'm sure he's a really great guy. But I did note that he just is like a writer for like the local newspaper out in the Berkshires.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, did he write that about himself? You know what I mean? Like, it's just like a little one-off thing. Okay. So then nearby, there's also Clapp Park, and that's also haunted. So I found this little like blurb about Clapp Park from Berkshire.com. Clapp Park, well-known park in Berkshire County, showcasing one of the biggest sledding hills in the area.
Wait, hang on. Why do we have a British accent now?
I don't know. I just thought it'd be fun.
You confused me. I'm like, wait, go to England?
No, it's just like an old-timey accent. So the well-kept playground and athletic field, this park offers a lot to the community. From basketball, baseball, and softball games to picnics on the grass, Clapp Park is host to a variety of outdoor activities and events in the Berkshires. People come from all around to spend time with their families in this prominent spot, watching sports, walking the track, enjoying all age-appropriate playground and events set up by the city. Spending time here is great if you're looking for a nice family outing. Ba-da-da! Okay. So then, as I was thinking of that, I also found like some other stuff. It's apparently people most often see this tall, shadowy figure near the old railroad tracks that run behind the park. And like, there's always like disembodied footsteps, sounds, voices, blah, blah, blah. But so since the 1950s, and this is what it's really known for, people report seeing the phantom steam engine train running behind here.
I know nothing about this, but I want It makes me think of Abraham Lincoln's ghost train that is seen out in Illinois sometimes.
Ooh. Yeah. That's all I got on the Clap House and the Clap Park.
Well, that was cool.
Thanks.
Yeah, out in Pittsfield. Pittsfield is one of the larger towns out in Western Mass, I think. I'm looking at it on the map and it's nice and square shaped.
That's where Lauren's from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where she grew up. One thing about Pittsfield that will upset people, and it upsets me, even though I don't really care, is that they tend to be Yankees fans out there.
What?
Because it's like basically in New York. But I'm like, but you're not in New York. You're in Massachusetts.
I'm counting to a million in my head so I don't get upset. Hey, you know, if you want to root for the Yankees, you go and root for the Yankees. But I heard it described once, rooting for the Yankees is like rooting for U.S. Steel, right? It's like rooting for Bank of America. It's this huge company that it couldn't possibly fail. So, yeah, it's that's my idea there. All right. Hey, you want to hear about the Hoosac Tunnel, also referred to as the Bloody Pit?
Yes.
So the Hoosac Tunnel is located, it runs actually underneath a mountain. It's about 5 miles long, give or take, and it runs between Florida, Massachusetts, and North Adams, Massachusetts. Did you know that we have a Florida, Massachusetts? I'm too close to the microphone. Did you know that we have a Florida, Massachusetts?
I did know that. Me and Mike from Arizona actually touched upon that together the other day. He was talking to me about, no, we found some, there was like something online that was like all the worst names of in every state, like worst town names. And in Massachusetts, it was Satan's Kingdom. And
that's not a town in Massachusetts.
Yeah, it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it's in Western Mass. Okay. Satan's Kingdom is an unincorporated village in the town of Northfield, Franklin County, Massachusetts. Satan's Kingdom is 1.5 miles northwest of Northfield and is near the Vermont border.
According to my map, Northfield runs straight from Bernardston to Warwick and borders on Vermont the whole way. There is no...
It's a village.
Whatever.
But I said it's a village.
Satan's Kingdom is not a town in Massachusetts.
No, it's not that. It's Satan's Kingdom.
Satan's Kingdom is not a town in Massachusetts.
My goodness, Beth. Potty mouth of the year over here.
All right. Anyway, yeah. So we have a place called Florida, Massachusetts, and that is where the eastern end of the Hoosac Tunnel is. So it was built from 1851 to 1875. And during the 24 years of construction, 200 men died. All right. So they built it to be
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What year was this?
1851 to 1875.
Okay. Got it. So that's a lot of people.
It is. So they built this in order to have a tunnel that runs through a mountain. It's actually some like magnificent engineering feat, which is, you know, really terrific that we have this here in Massachusetts. But as you can imagine, there were a lot of really kind of nasty deaths that happened. So in March 20th, 1865, there were three men who were working in the tunnel, and they were using some explosives. So Ned Brinkman, Billy Nash, and Ringo Kelly. I'd never heard of anyone else named Ringo. There was that guy on the Beatles, and now this guy. You ever heard of anybody else named Ringo?
No.
Okay, so Ringo plants the charge, and the three of them go running off to take shelter behind their whatever they have is their little like blast shield. Ringo is the guy with the detonator in his hand. And for some reason, he sets it off early before his two friends can also get behind the safety thing. So the other two guys are out and they get crushed by all the stone that falls from the explosion. And apparently they're buried alive under there. So about 10 days later, Ringo disappears. And he's not seen again until a full year later. Now it's March 30th, 1866. His body is found in the exact spot that the explosion happened. There's some speculation that he was strangled, but nobody knows who strangled him. There were never any suspects. There was a lot of people talking about the fact that it was clearly the ghosts of Ned Brinkman and Billy Nash, who grabbed hold of him and strangled him for, you know, killing them with the detonator. There was also a report that the police came in and had established a time of death between like midnight and 3 a.m. But I'm a little skeptical of this because he was missing for a year. Was he kidnapped for a year and held somewhere and just murdered the night before and left there?
Oh.
Or was he murdered sometime in the year between when he disappeared and when he was found? And in that case, how did they know his time of death? And wouldn't he have been, decomposing a bit? It's like, how would they have been able to tell all of this stuff? So anyway, I didn't care for that. But those guys really died in an explosion, and that guy really turned up a year later, also dead. So that was kind of weird. Okay, so next up, we have October 17th, 1867. So they were making an exhaust vent for the mountain, and so they had to drill 1,000 feet through the mountain, or 100 stories, to get from the top of the mountain all the way down into the tunnel so that the exhaust fumes could go out. So they were a little over 500 feet down, when all of a sudden there's an explosion, and the hoist that they used to lower the men and the equipment and everything down into this, you know, 500 foot hole in the ground so they could keep digging, the hoist gets destroyed. And so all of this equipment and stuff falls down on these men on the bottom, right? And also down on the bottom, there were a series of water pumps because water is pouring in. So something has to pump the water out in order to keep the men dry, you know. So The pumps get destroyed and now it starts filling up with water. So they have a guy up at the top and they lower him down on a rope. And they're like, you got to tell us what you see down there because we have to go and save, you know, anybody that we can. So they lower him down. He gets to the bottom. He has a look around. He comes back up and he's like, there's no hope, right? He's like choking and almost unconscious from all the fumes that are in there from the flames, the explosion, the fire. There was some sort of gas that caught and went up. Anyway, 13 men were down in the shaft when the explosion happened. And so they didn't find them for quite a while after that. They did, however, find a raft that the survivors of the explosion had built. So the survivors had built this raft and they had climbed on it and they slowly like starved to death, like down here in this pit, and nobody could get them out. It's horrible. Yeah. So between the time when the explosion happened and the survivors were found, the missing miners were actually the ghosts of the missing miners were seen carrying picks and shovels to work, like going up to the top of the mountain every morning to go to work. Right. And they would appear and somebody would see them and they wouldn't respond to any calls. And then they would just disappear. This actually stopped. It was never seen again after the bodies were found and given a proper burial.
Wow. So
that was really sort of neat. Okay. October 16th, 1874. So this is, I believe, right at, no, this is right before the tunnel opens because it opened in February of 75. So there's a hunter who lives in the area and he vanishes. And 3 days later, so now we're talking October 19th, he's found in shock, just kind of wandering around disoriented. And his story is that some strange voices told him 3 days before to go into the tunnel. He gets into the tunnel and he sees all these ghosts just sort of like milling around. He's got his rifle with him. You know, he's a hunter. Something takes his rifle from his hand, beats him unconscious with it. And the next thing he knows, he's out wandering around outside, not knowing what happened, how he got out of the tunnel, or even where he is. So it was lucky that they found him because he was probably gonna die.
Wow.
All right. So I have another story here. This is an account from the HoosackTunnel.net. So 4 years after the gas explosion, right, when all the miners were killed, there's a Dr. Clifford J. Owens who visited the tunnel, accompanied by James R. McKinstry, a drilling operations superintendent. Dr. Owens wrote the following account, which was thought to have appeared first in a Michigan newspaper. On the night of June 25, 1872, James McKinstry and I entered the great excavation at precisely 11:30 p.m. We had traveled about 2 full miles into the shaft when we finally halted to rest. Except for the dim, smoky light cast by our lamps, the place was as cold and dark as a tomb. James and I stood there talking for a minute or two, and we were just about to turn back when suddenly I heard a strange, mournful sound. It was just as if someone or something was suffering great pain. The next thing I saw was a dim light coming along the tunnel from a westerly direction. At first, I believed it was probably a workman with a lantern. Yet as the light grew closer, it took on a strange blue color and appeared to change shape almost into the form of a human being without a head. The light seemed to be floating along about a foot or two above the tunnel floor. In the next instant, it felt as if the temperature had suddenly dropped and a cold, icy chill ran up and down my spine. The headless form came so close that I could have reached out and touched it, but I was too terrified to move. For what seemed like an eternity, McKinstry and I just stood there, gaping at the headless thing like 2 wooden Indians. The blue light remained motionless for a few seconds as if it were actually looking us over, and then floated off toward the east end of the shaft and vanished into thin air. I am above all a realist, nor am I prone to repeating gossip and wild tales that defy a reasonable explanation. However, in all truth, I cannot deny what James McKinstry and I witnessed with our own eyes. So that's a crazy story, you know, just 2 guys going in and hunting around, seeing it. People have a lot of trouble, even up to this day, going in and staying in the tunnel. They have people who are responsible for maintaining and keeping the tunnel safe, and they apparently are like, that's not a thing. It's not hunted. It's not hunted. That's not a thing. It's not haunted. But they won't actually spend any more time in the tunnel than they have to. They're not, like, not even one extra second. They want to get out as fast as they can. A lot of people, when they're in there, they hear cries and groans, and they'll see just lanterns, it looks like, bobbing along the tunnel. So, Yeah, it seems like a very, very interesting place that might be worth exploring. But they do still run trains through there. Not as often as they used to, but there's a couple that go through there still every day. So the recommendation, if you want to look at the tunnel, is to go to the Florida end of the tunnel and look from that side. And it's private property, so you're not supposed to go on there. And, you know, most importantly, if you were to go in there, you might get run over by a train. So maybe don't go in there, but it's,
yeah, be careful.
It's a cool idea. Anyway, that's my story.
Good story, Beth.
Thanks, Amelia.
You're welcome. Okay. So next, I found online a bunch of legends out of Mount Holyoke College. So for those of you who don't know, Mount Holyoke is a all-woman school. It is located in South Hadley, Massachusetts. It's a 4-year college. It's a very nice school. And here is a little bit about that. Before I begin, I want to be very clear where I got this from. I got all this from JacquelineABelson.com, and it's her private blog, and she has way, way more than I'm going to share tonight, but I did find these. So I looked up them in some other places too, but this is a lot of where I got it from, is JacquelineABelson.com.
Are you sure it's not JacquelineAbelson.com?
I know. I have no idea. I've never met her.
Okay.
So here's our first story. Ooh, the Lady of Lower Lake. Ooh. Sometime during her spring semester at Mount Holyoke, a young student learned that she would not be graduating with her fellow classmates. She was a senior and had become very distraught when she discovered that she failed all 4 of her exams. Her parents couldn't afford another semester of college. They had spent all of their life savings to send their only child to receive a good education all the way out in Western Massachusetts. And what they got in return was nothing. Driven by stress and guilt, the night before what should have been her graduation, the student went outside and crossed the tiny bridge above the waterfall of Lower Lake. Today, the bridge is known as Spider Bridge because it's always crawling with spiders.
The student perched herself upon the ledge and tied a rope around her neck, but not before drawing out a knife and plunging the blade straight through her chest. Once she had cut herself open, she fell straight off the bridge with the noose around her neck. Later that night, another student walked across the bridge to return to her dorm when she heard a voice saying, "Help me, I'm down here." Naturally, the student looked over the bridge and saw the bloody and strangled body, the suicidal student's icy toes dangling just above the water. When the student called the police, they cut the rope and dragged the body down to the bridge. However, when the student recounted hearing the words, "I'm down here," the police gave her a look. The body had been hanging over the bridge for more than an hour. To this day, every night during final weeks in the spring, some students have claimed to see the Lady of Lower Lake swing from the bridge or even heard her whisper, "I'm down here," as students cross the bridge during the late hours of the night. And that is the story of the Lady of Lower Lake.
So be very careful if you're walking across that bridge. If somebody shouts, "I'm down here," you should help them up.
Run.
Run. Okay. No, help them up.
Okay. So next we have the legend of the starving girl. So the year was 1967 and she was living in 1837 Hall overlooking Lower Lake. The girl was the first year and her parents had high hopes for her to marry a prominent young man from Amherst or Dartmouth by the end of her senior year. Once the girl moved in, her mother stayed in South Hadley for a little while, getting her settled, signing her up for a couple of courses to better hone all of her homemaking skills and accompanying her for a soiree with eligible men from around Pioneer Valley. Everything was going exactly as planned until it wasn't. At the soirees, no men found the girl attractive, and the girls on her floor were talking constantly about the latest dieting fad. The girl became convinced that her unattractiveness resided in her weight. She called her mom and told her these fears. Her mom, on the other hand, only added to the daughter's distress. Well, she was enrolled in all prestigious all-women's college, a competitive market if one wanted to mingle and breed with the right kind of people. Ew, breed with the right kind of people, gross. It's like a very crass way of putting that. I'd rather you just use profanity than say that. Okay. This only brought on more pressure about the girl's appearance. So suddenly she stopped eating. "Come eat with us," the girls on her floor would try to coax her, but she declined. The girl refused to eat. She ate nothing all day and nothing all night. She claimed to have already eaten her breakfast before leaving to go to class, and she would purposely fall asleep through her lunch period. The other girls on the floor could feel the stress coming off of her, palpable and terrifying. Nobody acknowledged any of this, at least not out loud. Anorexia was a mental disorder after all. But nobody dared to be involved in something they themselves could not understand. All at once, the girls on the floor just stopped socializing with her. Sure enough, the girl grew skinnier and skinnier. Before, according to her neighbor, she was glowing, but a month later, she was gaunt. Her eyes sunken into her face, her head too big for her body, and her skin turned an ashen pale. The fat in her wrist had reduced to thin, knobby sticks, and all the tendons in her neck bulged like little puppet strings whenever she turned her head. She just looked brittle. A week before Thanksgiving, the girl's neighbor invited her to come with her to the holiday. She had taken pity on the girl and thought that maybe a home-cooked meal and a plump little turkey might make her look more lively. When she knocked on the door, no answer. 3 days went by. The neighbor figured maybe the girl had already left with the other students for Thanksgiving break, so left. After the week back home, full of pumpkin pies and stuffings, the neighbor returned back to 1837 Hall, but noticed the girl's door was still closed. The other residents on the fifth floor became curious about her whereabouts. As far as they had known, the girl didn't go home with anybody for Thanksgiving. But Monday, the girl's door was still closed. One girl reasoned that she had went home early and missed the last bus to take her back to Mount Holyoke. But by Tuesday, the door was closed. Wednesday, nothing. And Thursday, people really started to worry. That Friday, the girls on the fifth floor woke up their house mother, who got the spare key to the girl's room. So the house mother headed upstairs, the girls following behind her. Once at the door, the house mother fit the key in the lock and turned it open. The girl was lying on top of her bed, her cheek pressed to the window. She was curled up completely naked. It was a very sight that terrorized both the girls and the house mother. The girl was all bones. every bump in her spine protruding invisible. Her hips poked out at odd angles, and her knees were skinny and pale. The sharpness of her shoulder blades rose out of her skin like the wings of a baby bird. She had starved herself and died. 1837 Hall sealed off her room for 3 years before reopening it again. But her presence, no matter how thin she had spread herself in life, filled up the entire fifth floor of the dorm after death. Over the years, the students had recognized seeing her in their room, reporting that the woman, wrath-looking, would be staring right back at them. Despite that she had died in her room, the most activity reported in the fifth floor is actually in the bathroom. This made sense since she was found naked, and the bathroom is likely to be the only place for her to purge any meals she had eaten while suffering from her eating disorder. One student claims to have woken up at 3 a.m., gone to the bathroom on the fifth floor, and as she was washing her hands, looked up and saw a thin woman gazing right back at her.
Ooh.
Spooky.
Very spooky.
So our next legend out of Mount Holyoke is the Pearson Murder Ghost. There are two structures on the campus, both named Pearson's. The dorm, Pearson Hall.
Did you actually title this one before you started?
Yeah, the Pearson Murder Ghost. There are two structures on campus that are both named Pearson's. There's a dorm, Pearson Hall, and right next to it, Pearson's Annex, a building that's supposed to be actually older than Pearson's Hall itself. The administration building was believed to be built before 1810 and was known in South Hadley as Brick Store. The college purchased it and converted it into a first-year house, bestowing the name given to the dorm next door. Throughout the years, it has multiple undergraduates, and today, it houses Francis Perkins Scholars. However, before Pearson's Annex was adopted by the school, the owner of the Brick Store lived there with his wife and child. Both were young and recently married. They had immigrated to the U.S. to escape the hardships that had befallen them in their home country of Ireland. But the wife had come from a very superstitious family. Her ancestors believed in fairy folklore, mostly stories about families substituting one of their own for a kidnapped human adult or child, a changeling, if you will. And this wife took this fairy folklore very seriously. Her logic was simple. If a child was born sickly or ill-tempered, they were often thought to be a fairy substitute, left behind when the real child was taken from the home. Or if an adult went missing and suddenly turned up again, people would often assume they had been swapped with a fairy that looked, sounded, and spoke exactly like their loved one. All the over-well-being of the wife's family was hinged into the knowledge of these changeling creatures. It started when the wife found out that her husband was having an affair with the woman in town. This was a sign to the woman that her beloved husband had been swapped by a changeling. Lately, her husband had been suffering from mood swings, becoming argumentative, and had lost complete and utter interest in spending time with his friends outside of work. Worse, she started to suspect even her own baby of being a changeling. The baby never stopped crying and always seemed to have an enormous appetite, an obvious sign that the baby she was caring for wasn't her baby at all. On a rainy night, the woman's husband left home on an errand. There was no doubt that the so-called errand was really an excuse to meet with his mistress. But later that evening, when he returned, things took a turn for the worst. Upon entering his home, he discovered a pool of blood in the middle of the kitchen floor, leading up to the sink. He slowly approached the basin of the sink. He saw a small pink body of his child, dead. That's when he heard the floorboards creaking behind him. He turned there as his wife charged to him with a butcher knife, the blade already bloody from the first kill. She tackled her husband to the floor. "You're not my husband. You're not my husband," she cried over and over again. She held his face in front of the burning fireplace while holding the butcher blade to his throat. She demanded that her husband state before God that he indeed was not her husband and a changeling. His wife was convinced that if she killed him, just like how she had killed the child she believed to be a changeling, then both the real baby and her devoted husband would come home. Again, she pressed the blade of the knife a little deeper into her husband's throat and demanded that he declare his identity. But this time, the husband refused. He pushed his wife off and rolled on top of her. Caught off guard, the butcher knife slipped out of her hands, and her husband scrambled to grab it before plowing the knife directly into the center of her chest. Now, both his wife and his child were dead. What happens next can only be speculation. In one telling, the realization of his dead wife and child sent the husband mad. The neighbors heard the screams and called the police. When local authorities entered the house, they found the husband trembling with the bodies and was taken to a mental institution where he died 30 years later. In another telling, the husband was so distraught at what he had done, he drowned himself in Lower Lake. Eventually, the brick store was sold to the school, but what horrific events had happened to both the husband, his wife, and his child haven't gone anywhere. Having extended herself, her spirit apparently reached the grounds of both Pearson's buildings. One sophomore who lived in Pearson's Hall awoke to see the light of her roommate's closet had suddenly turned on, only to be aware of a dark female figure standing right next to the closet door. In her report, the sophomore claimed that just by looking at the figure, she could tell that she was rabid with anger and kept making frequent visits again and again to the student's room, glaring at her with menacing eyes or whirling her arms in the air as if to hit her, or more precisely, by wielding a butcher knife. That's that story.
Good tales. Good legends.
Good legends.
Yeah.
Spooky.
Those were fun.
Yeah. So that's just three of them. There's tons. I couldn't believe how many there were at a Mount Holyoke.
Nice.
Yeah. You got anything else, Beth?
No, that's it for me tonight.
Cool. Yeah, so we have a lot of listener mail. Please, everyone, keep sending us more. We decided that we have, I don't want to say too much because that doesn't seem like the right word. Like, too much isn't what I want to say. We have so much that we're just going to do a bonus episode with all of the listener mail. So everyone gets an extra episode of Ghost Hunting in New England, which is great.
Although it does throw us off of our fancy number 13 episodes.
No, it doesn't, because there's still 13 episodes in the season plus one bonus episode.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else?
No, I have nothing.
All right. Well, you can reach us online. We are on the Facebook, Ghost Hunting in New England. We are on the Instagram, we're on the Instagram, Ghost Hunting in New England. Amelia is on Twitter, and she's always looking for more followers, Ghost Hunting NE. You can email us with your drive-by ghostings or any sort of correction information if you think we're getting things wrong, ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com. Please leave us a 5-star review anywhere you can leave reviews, unless it's on Audible, and then we want a 15-star review. Please and thank you, everyone. Anything else?
That's it. And as always,
happy hunting.